I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ain't all be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a far and deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program, here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. We're going to play a show from earlier this week. This is a weekly show, and I'm a participant in it. It's called The Ethno State. The host is William Johnson, the chairman of the American Freedom Party. The producer and also participant is Ken Givenan, and we usually have one or two other guests as well. So this is Paul Fromm, and this is the Ethno State this week.
Hello everyone, this is William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, here for another edition of the Ethno State. We have a great show today. We have, in addition to Ken Givenan and Paul Fromm, we have Tom Kaczynski, and he always has insightful and erudite comments. Welcome, you guys. Tom, I know that you are from Maine, and I was lying in bed when I couldn't sleep, and I thought, different things to try to get to sleep. I was thinking, what famous person can I think from each particular state? And I, first of all, you have to recall the states when you're lying in bed, then you have to recall who the famous person was. And I got to Maine, and I thought, the only one I could think of was Senator James Blaine. And I can't remember what he did. I think, was he like a presidential candidate against somebody?
Yeah, like back in the early, late 1800s. But most people would say Stephen King is the most famous Mainer.
Oh, I mean that writer that, what is it called, that spooky writer that hates Trump?
The very same.
Yeah, and I remember, okay, well, all right. Well, I guess that shows my age, if I could relate more to Senator Blaine.
Blaine was a politician. There was a great ditty about him, and that was Blaine, James G. Blaine, the continental liar from the state of Maine.
Okay.
What about Nelson Rockefeller? Is he from Maine?
I think he was from New York, but if I remember right, the old man Bush might have been from Maine. I know they had a residence up here, and there's a lot of things from there, you know, that are up here, you know, in support of him.
Is that Indian named Kenny Buckport, is that Maine?
Yeah, that is. It's just south of Portland.
Okay, so that's where you hear the Bushes and the Kenny Buckport is where they had their getaway, I guess.
I'm going to change my last name from Givitin to Buckport, so people can call me Kenny Buckport.
Okay, all right. Okay, in any event, before we get down to the brass tacks, Tom, I haven't talked to you for several months. What are you doing now?
Well, I've been busy writing books. I've written 3 books this last year, someone has to say it, Hidden History of How America is Lost, The Coming Civil War, and After Trump, which together make a sort of trilogy about problems that have been happening in America today. In addition, I do a lot of activism with my organization, National Right. That's nationalright.us, where what we are trying to do is transform the Republican Party in a much more nationalist direction. And other than that, I go out and
make good luck with that.
Well, you know what? A lot of people are sympathetic to the idea. Obviously, the donors aren't, but the people who support the party are. And, you know, we've seen populism can be a powerful force in the world today, and I think we can actually make some influence. We might not be strong enough to win an election, but we might be able to do enough to make that people who deserve to lose some. And it's funny how that somehow leads to the same outcome. So I try to be an optimist because otherwise it's really hard to do politics. But things have been going well. People like my writing. And ever since, you know, I ended up losing my job a year ago for speaking out for positive white identity, I've become, I think, a more effective advocate. And I've been able to build a sizable following who are willing to listen to that. And I respect that I've had a chance to speak to a lot of people like yourself and get to meet some of the great people in this movement who are in the fight with me.
Well, are you ever going to go back to being running cities as a city manager, or is that part of your career?
it's unlikely I would be hired to do my old job up here in Ender any now. But in the future, I may consider getting back into politics. So we'll leave that on the table as something to think about. But for the time being, I'm putting together some of my thoughts and trying to figure out how to be a more effective advocate and activist.
Okay, well, if you decide to run again, let us all know. We'll all get behind your campaign, and we'll see if you can actually get elected, because we need to get somebody elected to office.
Well, you and I will definitely have some conversations about that, because I got some ideas, but it's a little premature. You and I will do my very best.
Very good. And then, Paul, before this show started, you sent an email around saying that you wanted to discuss the very first topic was an issue that was not on Ken's list that we're going to go through, but I think is an important one. So can you tell us what the topic is, and then we'll dig right into that?
Yes, it's one of these issues where you don't know which side to boo. But a newly elected Somali member of the House of Representatives, Ilhan Omar, who represents a suburb of represents parts of Minneapolis, got herself into an absolute pit of trouble yesterday. She was discussing on Twitter the fact that so many Republicans are just so gung-ho for Israel, and she quoted a line from some rap song by some guy named Puff Daddy. And she said, it's all about the Benjamins. Well, that's apparently the Benjamin Franklin who's on the $100 American bill. And when, as the Twitter exchange continued, she mentioned APEC, which is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Well, the first thing I would say, ask, is it true? You know, everybody who knows anything about electoral politics in the United States knows that over 70% of the donations to the Democratic Party and well over 50% of the Republican Party come from Jews, and who constitute about 2% of the American population. So I objectively, I'd have to say, well, I don't see anything wrong here. I mean, it's a fact. But she was just inundated with calls for her resignation, even from President Trump. Demands that she apologize, that she was anti-Semitic, that this was, I used the word anti-Semitic trope. And I thought, you know, I've seen that before in the propaganda that comes out of Zionist groups like the Anti-Defamation League and so on. And I thought, trope, well, that's an odd word. So I don't think it's something that would normally come to mind. And I looked it up, and a trope is a metaphorical expression. I don't know what's metaphorical about what she said, but because people haven't heard it very often, they assume it must be something bad. And that's what some of the representatives who piled in on her and criticized her, and there was even talk that she'd be kicked off her committee assignments. But by the end of the day, she'd sort of apologized. She said she hadn't meant to hurt anybody, and she wasn't anti-Semitic and so on. But Anti-Defamation League said that they condemned her, quote, for promoting the ugly anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that Jews have an outsized influence over politics.
Well, I, with regard to that, I remember reading, I think in one of those articles, there have been a number of those articles the last day or two regarding this, is that the leader of some sort of Jewish political organization, I think maybe AIPAC or IPAC, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but he was meeting with somebody else, and he lit at a restaurant, and he picked up a paper napkin, and he says, you know what I could do? I could take this paper napkin to the Senate, and I could have 30 signatures in it within 45 minutes. And so that he was bragging about how powerful he was. And so if that, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not, but he thinks it's true. And so that certainly seems to be an outsized influence.
The Somali got it right on this one. It's not just the money, although that's important. The price of supporting Israel, the price of Jewish money in politics is support, unquestioning support for Israel. And politicians, elected politicians, know that if they don't get on board, that money will go to a primary challenger the next time around. They may not even be on the ballot, or will go to their opponent. They know that. And so she's absolutely right. It's money, not even necessarily the money that is given to them, but the knowledge that money could go to an opponent, and that the key issue is Israel. A number of the Democratic poobahs put out a statement that Nancy Pelosi and the caucus chairman, Hakeem Jeffries, and various others. We are and will always be strong supporters of Israel in Congress, because we understand that our support is based on shared values and strategic interests.
Is they all look out for the highest bidder. Congress, yeah. And you know, those lobbies have that in common, don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, also, I've watched world politics now for 50 years, and what I see is the international perception of Israel is following the same path, timeline, and trend that we see for Rhodesia and South Africa. There was a time when South Africa had a large support from the world because of what they had achieved. Then that dwindled and waned, and then finally it's collapsed, and the white society being kicked out. The same trend we're seeing worldwide regarding Israel. It was unthinkable that 20 years ago, or 15 years ago, or even 10 years ago, there would be such calumny and hatred heaped upon Israel by such a large and wide segment of varying portions of society. So I think that Israel is going to follow the same trajectory as Rhodesia, unless the Jews have an outsized influence. Over more than just America.
If I could interject here,
the one thing that makes it a little different, though, if we're going to be fair about this, is the Jewish influence in media, because the Rhodesian South Africans didn't benefit from that, and we can see, even though the argument that Congresswoman Omar made, which was on the surface of it reasonable enough, was utterly pilloried by the media in all different areas. Now, if someone was to criticize something, say, the apartheid regime of South Africa, you wouldn't have seen that in the same way. And as long as that sort of endures I think that Israel will probably survive a little while longer. But what's interesting is that the most involved activists on the far right and on the far left seem to have come to the same conclusion that it runs contrary to their interest in what they want to see develop in the United States to have such a large influence of the Zionist lobby.
The far left sees Israel as an imperialist power and so on. Most nationalists are isolationists, see it as a vortex that has sucked America into endless conflicts in the Middle East that basically do not achieve America's strategic interests. And you know, I spent an awful lot of money and several wars and prestige. I don't think we should have bend over backwards to curry favor with the Muslim world. But on the other hand, unquestioning support for Israel has certainly not won as many friends.
Well, you know, I don't watch a lot of sports, but there has been recently on occasion I've watched a boxing match, and two pugilists are going at it, beating each other up, and my wife will come along, and she says, "Bill, I hope they both lose." She wants them both to lose, you know, and because she doesn't care about either one of them. And I was thinking about this conflict between Congressman Omar and the Israel lobby, and I'm thinking, I want them both to win. I don't want them both to lose. I don't want them both to go away. I want them both to win. And the reason that is because I think they're each fueling a schism, a split, a division of America. Whereas most of America was aligned behind supporting Israel, the fundamental Christians, the politics, the various universities, and the captains of industry. But now, because of this schism that is driven primarily or started primarily by massive Muslim immigration into white countries, we're seeing a chipping away at the power of Israel and a split. And I can only see that as a good thing, because as the monolithic power of Israel and the Jewish lobby diminishes, then that will help, and the more hatred grows of international involvement, we're going to see a larger split, and that will lead, ultimately, I think, helps promote the ethno-state, the division into various groups that I think are necessary. That's my ruminations. No comment.
Well, I think you're right, Bill. I think that that's where it's going to go, and I think the more interesting thing in the short term is to see if we see the American right get even closer to Israel, and if that means any change in Jewish social and voting habits, if they try to encapsulate themselves once again within the Republican Party in a sort of re-embraced form of neoconservatism that will be pushed. Now, I know a lot of younger people aren't going to go for that, but it does seem like that might be the next strategic move they try to make, and I'm curious to see if, in fact, it plays out that way. Although I agree with you, over the longer term, we will probably see a diminution of the influence of the Jewish lobby.
This is where their other strategy will contradict that. Adelson, Las Vegas multimillionaire who's backed a lot of neocon candidates, he has three criteria to be a supporter, and one of them is to is that you have to be 110% pro-Israel. The other is for open borders and free and union. It's the open borders that will stick in the craw of the Zionist lobby, because they were the big force behind the change in the immigration law 1965, which threw open the doors to the third world and initiated over the intervening almost 50 years the third world, invasion and the beginning of a takeover of America. It'll be very hard for them to pull back on that. It'll be interesting to see, but I think our future lies with ourselves, not in who we can make alliances with.
Okay. Now, Ken, you have been markedly silent on this topic, but you come from a fundamental Christian pastor background. What's your take on this whole affair?
Well, the take on my take on this affair is reflecting on what Paul just said. It seems kind of counterintuitive. The Zionists would want to overwhelm the West with people groups that are anti-Zionist. I mean, it's kind of like they're intentionally turning the whole world against them. Are they so arrogant that they think that they can turn the entire planet, destroy Western culture, into this monolithic anti-Israel globalist empire and control it? I don't get that.
I could never
understand why among the favorite groups in Canada and the United States that they're bringing in Britain to our Muslims, who by and large don't like them.
Maybe it's the same mentality that the feminists have, who embrace all the Muslims, and the Muslims come in there and really oppress women. It's the same mindset that the white people have, open their borders to bring people in. Maybe it is this Pollyanna view on life to think, oh, America is so great, or the Jewish religion is so great, that we can bring these people in and we can get them to change their ways and have them assimilate and become contributing citizens of the community. And I think it's this misunderstanding of human nature that maybe drives the Jews, the fundamental Christians, the average white man, and the feminists, and the left-wingers, all to embrace a destructive principle.
You know, I think another piece of this, too, is that at some point habits become forming. Once upon a time, if you were bringing in minorities from other places, it gave an opportunity to make sure that other groups, like, say, Jews, would not stick out as much because people would be looking at them as just one in a basket of minorities. And that made a lot of sense back when America was 85-90% white. But the habits that were developed ended up continuing because they were never properly challenged, and now they've become habits that are self-destructive to the very people who created them. I would argue that's what identity politics has done to the left generally, where in fact the Indians are running the reservation, so to say, where they literally cannot control the demands of the identity politics groups, and where guilt was used to keep the majority in line. People who have been habituated over the course of their entire lives to think they are victims are not going to listen to that, and that's where you see this rising anti-Semitic view on the left that is going to be very difficult for them to reel back in.
Okay, wait, Tom, what you just said really struck a chord with me, and let me see if I got it right. You're saying that the Jews, when they were only a small minority in a 90% white country, were promoting the bringing in of other immigrants so that they would be a shield, they'd be kind of protected. They wouldn't be the only minority that are looked down upon. And then it's just growing exponentially, and so they can no longer control it. Is that your argument?
Essentially.
Oh, that's very insightful. I think that's exactly right. I'm going to embrace that and explain that next time I talk to an anthropologist.
I read that in Kevin McDonald's.
Kevin, I said hi.
Kevin McDonald's basically said the same thing. When people are coming in with turbans and there are women with bags over their head, a Jew doesn't look that much different than a normal European. He may have a funny hat on, but compared to a turban or some sort of long robe or a chador or whatever, he looks more like. So I can see that perhaps in moderation, but it's gotten out of control. There's a full-scale invasion of much of the West and the United States as well.
Well, you know what I think, Paul, though? I don't think that they maybe even anticipated how quickly Western civil society would collapse against the weight of a rising state, against a rise of secularism, the growth of technology and urbanization. If there was still a strong civil society with a church culture, with people, with traditional families, it would have been able to resist this, like was happening in the 50s and the 70s. But perhaps the sort of ideology that was brought in here was so successful because its opposition cratered, which is to say the people who were traditionalists in a lot of ways, And I think we can see that feminism, two person working families, all these things really took away the opposition. And once government started paying for social services, as the civil society disappeared, we ended up with no one who would oppose this. So the sort of idea that there was something that was going to have, there would be a push to change the population, would have pushback, didn't. And then it went to an excess which couldn't have been anticipated.
I think that is very insightful. And on that note, we're going to move to another topic.
Can I interrupt you and ask a question before you do that?
Yes.
Totally, completely off topic. But what is it with religious people and hairdos? You know, Orthodox Jews have these little curly things called peyotes they wear at the side. There are Krishnas have this thing where they shave their hair. Amish have this thing where they have like the Mo of Three Stooges hairstyle, like they put the thing. And all of these people, the women, they wear their hair really, really long and they pile on their head. I'm just wondering, there seems to be a connection.
Well, that's not the only example. You have the ancient monks would have, was it the tonsure, is what it's called? They'd have the bald spot on their head. And you have the Rastafarians, who believe Haile Selassie is God. They have dreadlocks. So I think hair is an important component of a religion. And so it does go across many different religions. That's true.
Yeah, when I was a fundamentalist Baptist, their thing was what I call the John Dillinger haircut. You had to wear your hair really short, like the men, not the women, obviously, but like Al Capone. I said, man, you guys look like a bunch of gangsters. That's totally off topic. The thought came to my mind when Paul was talking.
Well,
so.
No, I think that several, all of us here generally have desire to have more hair on top of our heads, but that's for a different story. Okay, in any event, let's go to the next topic. The topic that I want to, Ken, I want you to explain to us what it's all about. It's what's taking place in Hungary.
This is, let me clear my screen here real quick. This is a story that has something to do with kind of like a State of the Union address. Only, I guess, in Hungary they call it the State of the Nation address. And Prime Minister Viktor Orban has announced that the women in his country who have give birth to four children, don't have to pay personal income taxes for life. And that's not the only one. There are several things that they're offering, encouraging these women, Hungarian women, to make more babies. You get some kind of a credit just for getting married. You get some kind of a credit for having three kids. It's like they help you buy a minivan. I mean, seriously. And at the same time, Orban, as you guys know, is busy trying to keep non-Hungarians, particularly non-white people, out of his country. So it seems to me he's on the right track.
Comments?
Now, I think this is incredibly encouraging. A below replacement birth rate is something that dogs every white nation in Europe and in North America. We need 2.1 children per woman of childbearing age, and most of us are somewhere between 1 and 1.8. This is positive on a number of different levels. I heard Rams Paul talking about it last night, and it's positive because it's emphasizing families. It's when women get married. It's not supporting welfare mamas that just keep popping out kids. It's supporting stable families and helping the families acquire the infrastructure, like the vehicle and so on. And I think there's also a housing subsidy in there, too. That is really positive. And something that makes it easier for Orban than it will be for us in North America. Almost everybody living in Hungary, with very few exceptions, is Hungarian. If we were to do that in North America, well, we would also be subsidizing a lot of non-European.
Sense, Paul, they are doing it because they're subsidizing welfare people, which are overwhelmingly black and, to a lesser amount, Hispanic.
But, Yeah. That's my take exactly. What if we came out in this country and said, okay, all of those women who are of Nordic ancestry, Northern European ancestry, Central European ancestry, if you get married to someone of a like background and have four more children, no taxes. What would be the reaction if we came, if someone proposed that, or on the State of the Union? We all know there'd be a firestorm of opposition.
Yeah, I was going to say, a reaction from whom? I mean, for me, I'd give it two thumbs up. But
reaction from the white people that go to your church, they would be outraged.
That's why it will only work, I'm afraid, in an ethno-state. Whatever emerges from the breakup that may occur in the United States, if there are areas that are overwhelmingly white, that would be an excellent policy.
There is a nub of this that we might be able to salvage something from, which is the respect for the mother and wife. I think in the North American context, we really need to link this explicitly to marriage and into a lasting marriage with children from the same partner. And I think it's worthwhile. I mean, if you think of one of the big crimes within the white community in North America, I think feminism, frankly, is the biggest issue. Because when you look at how people identify themselves and you talk to people of any other race besides whites, they primarily identify as their race and then their gender secondarily. Whereas with whites, you'll see women identify first in solidarity with their gender oftentimes than before their racial identity. So if we can go ahead and promote this idea of the family and bring that back into focus by saying we're going to endorse, you know, women who are having children with a single partner who are staying married and who recognize that that has social value, I think that that actually does serve the purpose of moving towards the sort of identity we want, even as we will be paying for some people who are non-whites, obviously, to be following this. But I suspect that would be a small minority, at least in some communities, although it's a little trickier with the Latino community in the United States.
See, I disagree with that approach. I think we need to come out and say, all right, we need to have the whites in this country get married to whites and have large families. We need to increase the white population, and we need to decrease the non-white population. I think we need to have somebody, no matter how unpopular it is, come out and say that. And you come out and say, we want beautiful white children in our elementary schools. And eventually, when they, you know, what is that the phrase, was it by Alexander Pope? First abhor, then endure, then embrace. We need to have someone come out and do the abhorrence segment, and then later on they will endure it, and then later on they'll embrace it. But I think if we just do these things, oh, we need to increase the family, and we're going to be increasing the wrong type, and I think we need to have somebody that comes out and does it forthright. I think we should nominate Tom Krasinski to do it.
Well, I tell you what, I think that, you know, we have to get to the point where people can even just have free association at this point. But it would be interesting from a nonprofit perspective to see someone actually make a real push if there was a support league for real white families and white children. You see this for every other group, and I think that while the government wouldn't do that, I think there's a lot of room in the private sector to go ahead and move forward that way.
I got a way to handle this bill without the racial angle, and let's do it this way. Let's establish a policy where families where the husband and wife have an average IQ of 100 or higher, they will be the ones who get the subsidies. And what happens is, got a lot of white babies. Okay, you're going to have a few East Asians, you're going to have a few Jews, but by and large, you're going to have more white babies.
Okay, we could do that and add to that a melanin count of 10. I don't know if my science behind that was a joke, because I can't analyze it. But okay, but there is an ancillary article, or I don't know, an article post that I saw that I want to bring up now. There is somewhere on a college campus, I think it's in Paul Fromm's country of Canada, there's a single white guy wearing a vest, one of those yellow vests that they were wearing in France, and he has a sign that says, "White women are for making white babies," and he's on campus. And right next to him is you have a black man holding a sign that's kind of mocking him. It's got a picture of some sort of deformed SpongeBob grant with the same thing. White women are for making white babies, but the writing is all messed up, so it looks like some like it's retarded, so it's mocking him. And so I thought, well, that's a, first of all, the white guy that's holding that sign, white women are for making white babies, he's, two things came to my mind. One, he's ham-handed, because the approach sure is blunt and not artful. Second of all, he's kind of brave to come out and make that statement in a very unpopular country like Canada for this issue. Did either of you see that little thing that came around? It didn't get around too much, but it struck my attention. And the reason why it struck my attention, because when I see these type of articles, I like to go to the reader comments and see what kind of support we have for our views. And the reader comments were really discouraging. One of them, they're just all just call this guy all sorts of swear words and say he's stupid. Then when one white gal says, you know, if I were there at that area, what I'd do, I would go up there and I'd hug that black man next to him like he was James Bond and hold on to him and flirt with him. And all the comments by white people and all the black people were just criticizing this guy. Of course, admitted it was a ham-handed approach, but they didn't, none of them, very few of them were supportive. But I thought if the guy had come out and made did like Tom Kaczynski's approach, supported family, white, you know, women are for being mothers and having families, and doesn't mention that white women are for making white babies, but he shows a picture of a beautiful white family, kind of like my family, because you can't get more beautiful than that, except that's a joke, guys. But anyway, you get pictures of white families on that poster. Maybe that would mute some of the opposition. But when I read the opposition comments, it shows that there was a lot of ways to go before we're able to do what Prime Minister Orban did in Hungary.
Ken was on to something with a comment he made just a few moments ago about maybe using the criteria of IQ. The founding president of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, he was president for a long, long time, came up with a similar proposal. He was worried at the low birth rate in Singapore, which is overwhelmingly Chinese, and particularly among the more intelligent people. And he said that he was very worried that many young, intelligent women were employed, were in the business world or whatever, and obviously not having children, or at least not having many children. And he I don't know if they, I think there was an incentive program that he instituted, but I thought just that insight that it isn't even just, you know, churn out more bodies, but we should be looking to upgrade.
I think that's true, but you got to look at the other side of it. If we set an IQ limit of 100, we don't want to exclude King Dividend from that, so we need to maybe lower it a little bit.
Too late, Bill. I'm 66 years old. No more babies coming out of this body.
Okay, all right. Then we'll keep it at 100.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Actually, I don't know where 100
is. I hope
I'm not excluded. Okay, guys. Let's move on to another topic.
By the way, before you go on, at some point we need to bring up Tom's website so folks can get a glimpse of that. We don't have to do it now, but just at some point.
No, let's do it now. Tom?
Yeah, sure. Two websites I'd encourage you to check out, nationalright.us, which is my personal site. I'm in the course of upgrading that. And I also recommend people take a look at pendulum.online. It's a pro-white magazine that I edit. We have 10 different writers, and what we do is every 2 weeks we look at a different question from a pro-white perspective, a lot of different intersectional thoughts there, and shows people that we can find mature, responsible ways to deal with the issues in society today. So thank you for that, Ken.
You're welcome.
Very good. Everybody go to that site. Okay, Ken, tell us about the next one, the Texas police issue.
This is a story that comes out of Breitbart.com, and apparently what happened in Texas is the cops down there just got tired, just got fed up and tired of their state being overwhelmed by illegal aliens. Now, I call these people caravanistas, you know, coming from Guatemala or Honduras or wherever, but effectively what happened, best I can tell, is that the cops kind of like formed their own caravan And they lined up their vehicles side by side, according to Breitbart. I haven't seen the story anywhere else, but they lined up their vehicles side by side along the border in the town of Eagle Pass. So I guess the Eagles get passed, but the illegal aliens do not. Play on words, but yeah, it just shows that what the mainstream, what I call the mainstream Marxist media, is intentionally overlooking is this deep-rooted desire among Americans to defend their country. It's almost like it's just inherent, but this is truly, genuinely grassroots.
Okay, but this runs counter to what we see of a lot of government agencies doing. I mean, you have the governor of California withdrawing all of its troops from the border, saying we're not going to help President Trump in doing this. And you have so many government agencies running counter to what this Texas group is doing. So is it really that the mainstream media is hiding the fact that there's such great support, or is it this Texas police force is doing this in such a small minority that it doesn't make news?
Well, it's important to note that Governor Abbott in Texas was supportive of this effort. So I think what we see more is the polarization and division, that there are some people who feel extremely strongly that, the ongoing invasion is a terrible thing. And I think that's more true in Texas versus California, which is, completely abdicated its responsibilities underground and now Newsom.
Okay, well, one thing that comes to mind is that what Ken was talking about, how the media, mainstream media, was not covering it, but you had this border rally taking place at El Paso with President Trump, and then at the same day, you had, I think in Dallas-Fort Worth, you had Beto, the former congressman that ran against Ted Cruz, held a counter rally to oppose Trump's rally to build the wall. And one thing that came to my mind is that you had Donald Trump getting up there and saying, ridiculing the Beto rally. And he was saying, oh, we so overwhelmed the Beto people. We so did much better than how many showed up to the Beto rally. And there was a picture that I saw in the article. I said, it showed Beto was standing in a place where there weren't very many people around him. He said, what was it, 200 people, 300 people? And so that was what was reported on the extremely right-wing news sources that I read, and they only quoted Donald Trump saying that there were only 300 people at Beto's rally. And so that was accurate in that it reported what Donald Trump said, but it didn't go on to say how many people were at Beto's rally. So I came away thinking, well, maybe there were very few people that showed up. That's great news. Then I read somewhere else that Willie Nelson played at that group, and it was his rally in Dallas-Fort Worth was much bigger than Trump's rally. So what brought home to me is that fake news is popular on both sides of the aisle. If this time you had the extreme right wings underplaying the Beto group, just like what the mainstream media is doing, underplaying what Trump has achieved. That was my take on it right now, but,
It looks like there were from the pictures I'm looking at, of what Beto's rally was, somewhere between 4,000 and 10,000 people. So apparently it was pretty well attended, although there were, that many at the Trump rally as well, or more. So both were well attended, and I think that reflects the polarization that's ongoing.
Yeah, but also I believe Beto had Willie Nelson come out there to sing.
Sure.
And if I had a choice to go listen to Donald Trump or listen to Willie Nelson, I'd probably go listen to Willie Nelson, although I'd be a supporter of Trump. I can't grimace it.
But I'm just thinking, I've never heard Donald Trump sing. I don't think I'd want to go hear that either.
Okay, I guess maybe you're right. Maybe we're going to have this something after all, but one thing, and this is quite controversial, but it comes from a lot of people that I've not heard before. People are saying that we do not need to build a wall because a wall will really hurt the animals because they can no longer travel back and forth. and what came from some from the distaff side of my family, some of the women on my family, and comes from other people, they said, well, we should do what they do in the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. It's a lot cheaper to build gun turrets than it is to build a wall, and it won't affect the animals. These come from some women. And they're saying, you have absolutely no migration between North Korea and South Korea because of those gun turrets. And they said, that's environmentally, that's what you should have. And I guess this proposal probably would go over about as well as my effort to say white people should have babies and non-white should. But if you think about it, what North Korea and South Korea has achieved is a remarkably peaceful 15-mile-wide border. So peaceful, in fact, that they think that there are tigers that live in that area because no one goes there anymore. And if you take a look at the human tragedy that takes place by all of the immigrants that die of starvation or being or thirst when they come across, and once they get here, they kill all and rape all of the people that are citizens. Gun turrets would actually be a more humane approach. And so the challenge here is not whether or not we should advocate gun turrets, is whether or not this whole show gets banned by YouTube. What I'm saying.
Yeah, you don't have to shoot all the illegal aliens. You just shoot the first 10.
Yeah, and that would certainly be better for the environment, and it would achieve what North and South Korea have achieved magnificently. So, you know, yeah.
The border, though, between the two Koreas is much shorter than the very, very extensive American land border with Mexico. I might be wrong, but I'm an environmentalist, and I don't think there are any essential, like, species. I don't think the wall would be interrupting any species group.
Well,
it wouldn't matter for birds, but even for animals, I don't think that is a...
It will be devastating on the horny toad community, I can tell you that. And so...
they've been promising us this, the Democrats call this technological border wall. Maybe instead of, border turrets, you could have the drones be, doubling for Air Force practice, and use them that way, militarize the wall, or militarize the border without having a wall.
Yeah.
For the infrastructure, how much more
cost? That will only work if you are prepared to shoot unarmed people who can trespass. I don't know that America has the stuff to do it anymore. I think Hungary does, but I might be wrong. But
no, they have those crowd control weapons, right? Where like people who go near the speaker end up puking or something. You ever hear of these things they use? Where they put them out there and they put out different waves and make people sick. They call them puke guns. I know the Russians use them for certain things, but you could have those on speakers along the borders. You don't have to actually shoot anyone, but anyone who comes near too near to the border would lose their guts literally, and have to turn back unless they die of diarrhea or something.
Yeah, I think Hillary Clinton used those because every time people hear her speak, they start to puke.
Okay,
so apparently they work.
Okay.
Sorry.
On that note, let's move to another topic. Let's talk about this shoe thing. So, Ken, tell us about this shoe article.
Well, there are some celebrities who make a lot of money endorsing products. And now there are companies who represent, they're kind of like the middleman between, or middlewoman, sorry, going to be politically correct, between the celebrity and the companies who want their products endorsed. So there is a company representing Katy Perry, and they tied her with a company that makes shoes. And the shoes have little eyeballs on them and lips on them. I don't know who would buy these things, but some of the shoes, actually they look more like slippers, happen to be black. So you have black shoes with big eyeballs and red lips on them. And it looks like blackface. Now what they don't tell you is the same company makes various colors of these slippers. They even have some that have you know, they're not white, but they're kind of like beige. It's like white people. But the only ones they condemned are the ones that are black and look like blackface. Okay, couple sentences from Fox News. Katy Perry and her brand management company have issued a statement following concerns that some of her footwear items appear to resemble blackface. Did you guys notice I'm using my radio voice?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Perry, along with Global Brands Group, Global Brands Group, say they were saddened upon learning the backlash to their fashion line and confirmed the shoes were removed from sale. So there you go. Apparently racism is so rare in the United States, they got to make it up.
Okay, this is my take. I saw those shoes. They are absolutely hideous looking, no matter what color the main shoe is. And that called to mind, I remember when Michael Jackson was still alive, he came up with a line of shoes to compete with like the Air Jordans or whatever it was. They were tennis shoes made by Michael Jackson. And they didn't sell very well because I looked at them. They were the most gaudy, awful looking things out there. And so I guess you really don't want to have singers do make your shoes. But in any event, I did look at that shoe, and even though it was terrible looking, when the one that has the black background, you could not come to any other conclusion than it was a black face, a caricature. It was, you know, the lips are really red, the eyeballs are really wide, big and white, and the black background, it looked to me like it was black face revisited. So I could see why those shoes, because black face is so hated now, I can see why that shoe would really raise consternation among a lot of people.
Speaking of Michael Jackson, I actually saw a photograph of Michael Jackson when he was younger, and he was in blackface. That's a joke. I gotta tell people why I'm being funny. I mean,
yeah.
I must have a horrible sense of humor. Sorry, Paul, go ahead.
America has gone so crazy in terms of virtue signaling. If these products are offensive or not much good or just weird, people don't have to buy them. The market will decide. There's a very similar story involving Gucci in Europe. Gucci made a women's, I guess, fairly tight black sweater that comes up here, up to the nose and then bends, and there's a place for the mouth. It's sort of like we used to call it a dickie, but it's a turtleneck sweater that comes right up to the nose. And when you look at a very white model, I guess it could look like blackface. I mean, blackface is normally the entire face with exaggerated lips. But Gucci is the apologized all over the place and has been drawing the sweaters. I couldn't imagine who'd want to wear a sweater that gives you a. But even somebody who was commenting on this said, yeah, but isn't that what a bandana is?
That Gucci turtleneck was more reminiscent of what Antifa was now. So I guess if the Antifa people were a little more well-heeled and they could afford a Gucci stuff, they'd buy that sweater. This article caused me to look at...
It's $860 U.S., so I don't think we're going to be buying many of them very soon.
Yeah, but it caused me to look to see who Katy Perry is and what she did. Turns out she's a very popular singer worth well over $100 million and sold a lot of songs. And I read her background, and she is very left-wing, very pro-homosexual, very anti-white, and so much so that I believe that she would be horrified to see what this what her shoes looked like, and she probably was all for having them removed. But this called to mind, I read a little bit further about her case, and it turns out that she came from a fundamentalist evangelical Christian background. Both of her parents were evangelical Christians, pastors. So I thought, how did she get so messed up with that background? And then I read a little bit about their background. It turns out that both of her parents were very wild before they found and converted to evangelical Christianity. So I think there's something to be said for your genes there.
Even though you can convert to Christ and follow his teachings, your genetic makeout when if both mom and dad were super wild when they were kids, you know, you're not going to have much chance when you get older. Just like Miley Cyrus was a cute little girl when she was Hannah Montana, but then her genes kicked in and she became just like her mom and dad, I guess.
If I remember right, Katy Perry originally started out wanting to sing, you know, more in a gospel sense, and she couldn't cut it because she didn't have the skills. So one of the things I think we see again and again in Hollywood is they love this theme of corrupting people who come from, you know, decent backgrounds. And I think that, yeah, I don't know if you get bonus points, I don't know how that all works, but, you know, when they find someone like that and they can make her celebrity by basically eschewing her Christian upbringing and speaking explicitly against that. I mean, if you sort of buy into that whole Illuminati way that people like to present in Hollywood, she's at the heart of it with a lot of her different videos and the sort of occultic symbolism you see in that. And it's just one more sign of the fact that, you know, we have that culture that wants to corrupt people. And yeah, it complains about things like blackface, right? But it doesn't care about the fact that it's literally promoting every form of degeneracy imaginable.
See, I had a different reading on Miley Cyrus. I thought her father, Billy Ray, was an entertainer and, you know, had his own particular, you know, long hair look, the mullet look. But I've heard him narrate a couple of very interesting documentaries. I thought the real tragedy was the way she turned out. I mean, she became a real, I'm not sure if I can say it, a real stink, and that's not the worst thing I can say about her. I mean, and, disgusting, and she promised to move to Canada if Donald Trump got elected. I was kind of looking forward to that because I'd like to interview her and see what she thinks she can give me on country and western music, even though she's not part of it. But just kidding. I know she.
The election, Paul, she had this big crying fit where she said she was going to understand better and she was going to get back to her roots. And of course, you know, she got one video and then disappeared from the scene. And I'm sure she's back to something, you know. Debaucherous now, but
well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on lightresistanceradio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe, the dauntless hero, came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.